As Jesse the Body Ventura would say, that expletive is dug in like an Alabama tick, and I am that expletive in this case.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight or in the summer, pretty much whenever we get around to it, Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in a bicycle parking garage in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Yes, we're on the 8th floor bicycle parking garage. It's actually, I bike to work, but it is clouded over, and it looks still bright outside, but there are some very dark clouds in the distance, so it might be a very wet bike ride home.
And I was going to say, Ken, speaking of dark clouds, we're calling this a special emergency.
That was a very slick transition, Gabe.
And so, Ken, to set the ambiance here, as you can see, I'm in the United States, and I'm going to hold my microphone to the window to give you a sense of the screams of archaeologists outside. So sit tight, listener. Hold on just a second. You're gonna hear the screams.
My God.
Oh, it's brutal out there. I'd never actually known what the phrase rendering of garments meant, Ken, until I just looked out my window and I saw Cultural Resource Management rendering its garments. And so, Ken, we're tacking this on as a special, as I said, special emergency pod to the end of season 3. This is bonus content.
It is, yeah. So this is the first time I think we've had bonus content. So this is outside the canon. So this is like, for those of you who are Dragon Ball Z fans, this is like
one of the archaeologists just climbed into a canon. <It's>,
This is like the early Dragon Ball Z movies that are outside of the canon of the Dragon Ball world.
Mm-hmm. Dragon Ball Z for the Canadian listeners.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. But we're talking to a lot about American CRM right now, so I figured I'd use the Z.
Yeah, that's good. They appreciate that. So, Ken, what is the disaster that we are discussing? I guess looming disaster.
Yeah, so for those of you who have or have not been following the news, because I don't think even if you don't follow the news, it's hard to escape this stuff, there has been a lot going on in the United States as it relates to changes in legislation and regulation. And for those of you in the heritage industry, this is particularly important because of the changes that have gone on with a number of federal public servants and in the ways that funding is allocated in the United States to particular industries, particular fields, and particular types of research. And this is having an impact on archaeological regulation, the people who do the regulation, the funding for the offices that do the regulation, but also for people who are working in archaeology and some of the funding for projects that might involve archaeology. And so essentially what it is funding for projects, even for some of the development stuff that looked like it was going to be big money for industry over the next few years, some of the funding for projects like highways and things like that has disappeared.
I think that's right. And so how is the situation in Canada?
So in Canada, it's a little bit different in the sense that what we are dealing with right now are at the federal and at some provincial levels, the introduction of a series of bodies of legislation that are not deregulating, but changing their perspective on regulation as it relates to environmental legislation, and in particular,
sort of C-minus regulating, we'd say.
yeah, exactly. So what it is a shift toward a very developmental focus in that it's very pro-development and very looking to, I think the word that a lot of them are using is streamline regulatory review of major projects in Canada. And so obviously there is potentially some impact to archaeology in the sense that in the CRM industry, the bread and butter are these development projects. And so if, for example, there is a change toward more streamlined regulation, that likely means that there is potential for less archaeology work being done. None of that has actually happened yet, but they are a series of bills. So at the federal level, Bill C-5, And in Ontario, Bill 5, and in BC, Bill 15. And I don't actually have the names of those legislations right in front of me. Those statutes have changed kind of the face of what environmental rules are looking like. And it's not really clear how many of these things will actually survive court challenges and various different things. But all of this is happening at the same time. And so in the last few months, I think if you are a CRM practitioner, and if you own a company that does CRM work, it's probably been far more stressful than it usually is in terms of like what's next, the next year or next couple of years going to look like.
Okay. And Ken, how are we going to address this on the New Brunswick Archaeology Pod today?
So we are going to be speaking today with Dr. Christopher D. Dorr, who is the president-elect of the Society for American Archaeology. Chris also owns a business, Heritage Business International, or is the director of it. And so he has studied the CRM industry for a number of years, but Chris has also been involved with a number of archaeological organizations across North America. Kind of has his finger on the pulse of what's going on in the States in particular, but he's also an adjunct.
Or has his finger trying to find the pulse right now.
Yeah, and and so these are some of the questions we're asking him. The SAA has been very involved in lobbying advocacy on the behalf of CRM practitioners and archaeologists across the United States, because it's not just CRM. There is having an effect on funding for research projects as well, with particular focuses. And so speaking to Chris about this for the U.S. situation is important. And he also is an adjunct prof at Simon Fraser. And so I think pays attention to the Canadian industry and has a pretty good sense of what's going on there as well.
Exactly. And to help enhance the gravitas of the situation, the listener can't see it, but Ken and I are actually both dressed like Jesse the Body Ventura in Predator for this special event, because we ain't got time to bleed. And so I think at that, what we're going to do, Ken, is hand it over to our interview with Chris Dorr.
Yes. And so we'll be back to our regular scheduled programming sometime in August for those of you who are listening right now. And we'll be launching season 4. And so this episode doesn't have a hit pieces. It doesn't have a prize read or anything like that. But we felt like it was not going to be evergreen content, and it's particularly timely. So we're a hot button. We're a news organization really now on this podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a roving correspondent here in camouflage and full helmet.
You're embedded. You're an embedded journalist.
As Jesse the Body Ventura would say, that expletive is dug in like an Alabama tick, and I am that expletive in this case. And so, Ken, but before we switch over to the interview, if the listener has questions or comments, where would they send those?
They would send them to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram, at @new_Brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
Or you can find us on Ken's LinkedIn if you want to wade through the piles of unemployed archaeologists on the way to that.
Yeah.
So we will talk to you momentarily, listener.
Talk to you soon, listener. All right, we are back with the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and we are joined today from Tucson, Arizona, Dr. Christopher D. Dorr, PhD, MBA, RPA, MCIFA, so that's member of the Charter Institute of Archaeologists, who is an archaeologist and business consultant, and who has taught about and studied the heritage and CRM sector for over 30 years. Chris has a PhD from the University of New Mexico, an MBA from the University of Arizona, an MA from Penn, and a BA from Washington State University. Chris is also an adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University and University of Arizona, and runs Heritage Business International, a consulting firm aimed at improving business operations for CRM firms in the U.S. and Canada. Chris has published in Latin American Antiquity, Journal of Field Archaeology, Journal of Archaeological Method and Theory, to name a few. But today, he is joining us to discuss his work serving the discipline. And he's a past president of both the American Cultural Resources Association, or ACRA, and the Register of Professional Archaeologists, which is actually where I met Chris, a former director and now president of the Society for American Archaeology. And it is in that capacity that he has found time to talk to us about the state of archaeology and the CRM industry in the U.S. and perhaps also in Canada. So thanks for coming on, Chris.
You're welcome. Pleasure to talk to you, Ken and Gabe. I appreciate the invitation.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Chris. And congratulations on being named the new SAA president.
Thank you.
As we're going to get to, it's probably a pretty interesting time, or maybe even a mixed blessing at the moment. But we wonder if you could tell us a little bit about just your journey to running for that position and what sort of goals you have for your term as SIA president.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, Ken talked a little bit about my background and experience. And, you know, one of the things that I've always advocated and tried to practice, you know, is that professional service is a part of being a professional archaeologist. And I mean, there are just too few of us. And if we don't all pitch in to help us, we're all completely lost. So, you know, I first got involved with SAA. I've done professional service, you know, for my entire career and even before. So I first got involved with SAA on the Student Affairs Committee back in like the 1980s when I was a graduate student, and have, you know, since that time served on a myriad of different committees and, you know, as Ken mentioned, a director and treasurer after that, and editor of one of the journals, you know, and finally you run out of things to do and somebody asks you like, hey, you know, would you run for president? And it was a good time for me for one last kind of big professional service commitment and effort. And I said yes, you know, won the election, and here I am. So it's the journey, you know. And it's not, you know, any of these big offices aren't things you really like run a campaign for, but it's you know, it's based on your commitment. It's based on a lot of other jobs pitching in, and finally you kind of get the experience and probably better, more the context and perspective to be able to step into a role of president of one of these organizations.
Yeah. And so you would have served a year as the president-elect, and then you'll have a two-year term, and then you'll be the past president for a year afterwards. Is that kind of how it
there
works?
There is no past president SAA.
Oh, really?
There's kind of some things you do. You kind of corral the other past presidents in case the current president wants to get in touch with all the past presidents for counsel. But there's really no position. But you're correct. It's a three-year term. I'm about halfway through the 3 years. So I'd served as president-elect, kind of learning the job under our past president, Dan Sandweiss. And then I'm in my first year as president, and I have, you know, roughly a year and a half to go.
Right on.
Great.
So before we dive in here, kind of talking about your role, and this is a really loaded question, so I thought maybe you might have feedback on this, could you give the listener, because we're going to be talking a lot about American CRM industry, and we know we have a lot of American listeners, but we also have a lot of people from Canada who aren't as familiar with regulation. We've talked a little bit about the Canadian industry, but could you kind of give the listener a Coles Note version of how archaeology is regulated in the U.S. and generally how funding for these offices is working, and then we'll kind of lead into how those things have changed, basically.
Sure. I think, you know, there are probably a few principles that characterize the process. And I know, you know, this may be different from you guys and your listeners, but when you hear me, you know, using the term American, I'm talking about all of the Americas. I'll say United States if I'm talking about the United States. So and I'll get into this, you know, probably later when you start probing me. But, you know, SAA is truly an international organization, and we have 20%, a full 20% of our members live outside the United States in a lot of different countries. I think it's 70 or 80 different countries are represented. So when we make policy at SAA, we need to very much keep that in mind, that we're not talking about the United States, right? So. But within the United States, regulation for heritage resources, you know, unlike Canada, where there's very few national, you know, laws, everything's kind of province by province. Within the United States, we do have some large federal laws that pertain to heritage resources and archaeological resources at the federal level. But they also trickle down. So we have laws at state level, at county levels, municipal levels, and at tribal levels. And, you know, that's where the oversight and policy really takes place for compliance. Funding for all of those, you know, and for regulation and stewardship on jurisdictional lands comes from whatever kind of level of government, right? Cities will provide funding for oversight of cultural resources on city lands if they indeed have a city program. Some do, some have great, strong programs. So, you know, within those land jurisdictions, whatever government agency it is manages those resources, and usually it's government funding at that level. The private lands is completely different. So the United States is a country that has, you know, huge private land rights. And so unlike other countries where heritage resources, you know, patrimony of the nation, regardless of the property they're on, that doesn't exist that way in the United States. So archaeological resources on private land go with that owner of the land. The one exception are when there are human remains present, then other laws usually come in to manage human remains, whether it be criminal or cultural or however that works. And then we have the compliance process, right? The development-driven compliance process. Well, first off, and that process has, it's an evaluation process, right? So it doesn't have a preservation determined outcome. The process simply forces in this case, it's the government agency that's responsible for that, to weigh the value of heritage resources against the value of some development infrastructure project. And so the outcome isn't specified in our law. That's one thing that's a unique point. It comes from federal law, but it trickles down into these other laws that largely mirror the federal laws. The other thing that makes the United States somewhat unique is that the responsibility of compliance lies with the government. But the actions of compliance can be delegated. So you can't delegate the responsibility, but you can delegate doing the work and paying for the work. So on a development project, it's typically the developer who is a government agency providing oversight and saying what needs to be done, but it's the developer that will go out, typically sometimes in-house, but will hire a contractor and pay for the archaeological work that gets done under the oversight of the agency or the regulator in that case. So that splitting of the responsibility from the acts is a key component. So in a nutshell, you know, without getting into specific laws, that's generally kind of how, who does what, who's doing the work, who's doing the oversight, and where funding. So most of the funding for the boots on the ground archaeological work really does come from the private sector and from development and industries. The money for oversight and regulation tends to be government money.
Great. And so Chris, you mentioned, used the phrase, I think, conflicting values. And so maybe that actually contributes to some of this next question, right? Where these are obviously challenging times for the profession. And you've really seen this, you know, I suspect, you know, your work in RPA and ACRA and now with SAA too. What are some of the biggest challenges for archaeological practice that we're either in or that you're seeing on the horizon?
You know, a lot of the focus, again, you know, because I'm in the United States and the majority, you know, 80% of SAA members are within the United States, you know, we're focused on the politics that are happening with the United States. But, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we and SAA and myself, we're trying to take a broader viewpoint when it comes to these issues. And, you know, these issues will resonate with all the listeners because they're the same. So putting, you know, country-specific politics aside, and, you know, there are some similar differences on similar things going on the political side, certainly, between what's going on in Canada and the United States on some aspects, but too in the, you know, Argentina and, you know, in far South America, there's a huge anti-science movement that is causing defunding of archaeology and undercutting, you know, professionalism and, you know, archaeological scholarship and things like that. So there are fewer differences, I think, than you think there might be. But putting all those political things aside, you know, what are the big issues that really undercut American archaeology in the broad sense and, you know, the challenges that we have? And I would say, you know, one that's pretty universal, even beyond the Americas, is creating sustainable, rewarding, and well-paying careers. You know, we have jobs, but jobs are very distinct from careers, and we don't have enough of them, and they're not rewarding. They don't, you know, pay well. We all know, everybody listening to this podcast certainly, you know, is well aware of the state of archaeological employment. So that's, you know, one of the big challenges. I think another one, you know, I just talked about kind of the anti-science movement. I think public perception of archaeology as a science, you know, and just the undercutting of experts in general, right? We're in an era, you know, where scholarship, professionalism, informed opinions, science, facts are being rapidly eroded, and it's more ideologies, and, you know, it doesn't matter about your professional training or your background, right? It's just what you believe, right, is giving now more weight than rational thought, science, facts, and the process of reasoning out for us, you know, reasoning out what we think happened in the past. So I think public perception of science, of any experts, and certainly of archaeology is a key issue that we're all concerned about. And I think maybe, you know, a third one might be building better partnerships with communities and stakeholders. And that's, you know, it's partially justifying what we do, especially since there is taxpayer and government funding involved. So it's ensuring that, you know, taxpayers are receiving a benefit from what we do. But also a lot of the issues and a lot of the problems that have come into archaeology, you know, certainly in the last decade, but have roots much, much farther back. But about how we treat ourselves, about, you know, relationships with First Nations, Native Americans, you know, descendant communities, and just cultural stakeholders in general, that archaeology has, I think, started moving down a better path of engaging and truly partnering with communities and those stakeholders. But we have a long ways to go. And, you know, in my mind, really, that community partnership is, you know, a fundamental element to kind of the archaeology of the mid-21st century, which we're kind of finding ourselves in all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I think...
Snuck up on us.
Yeah, and I think, too, like, this idea of building partnerships and community-level stuff and kind of that local... do you get a sense that that is a strategy to combat kind of number two, which this is sort of, you know, this, what's the word? I guess not resistance, but this sort of anti-science, this kind of a little bit of not as much trust in science, I guess, as there used to be, and you know, the kind of emotional side of it. But by localizing things, by making them more community-based, is that sort of a strategy maybe to combat this second big issue?
I think it is, and I would, you know, I mean, you could put it into more political terms. Certainly, what's going on in the States, right? You know, there's not a lot we can do as archaeology, even with archaeological issues, right? But with other issues too, at the national level, right? Our administration within the United States, our federal national administration, you know, has it out for us in a lot of ways that we have held close. And there's not a lot we can do given the way that political power lies now to affect much change at that level. So I see, you know, within life in the United States, in all kinds of ways, everybody's turning into their local communities. Localism is becoming a really strong thing, whether it be local pirate radio or your culture, your arts scene, taking care of the needs of people within your own community. Everybody's starting to look in, which I think is a really great thing. And I think archaeologists are doing that as well. Because, you know, we can control that, and we can influence that, and we can make a difference at the local level. So great. I think localism is kind of the new thing for a while in all kinds of aspects of our lives.
That's really interesting. And so Ken's going to ask a FOB question here about lobbying and government, but I wondered if I could ask a FOB question, too, just about your own background. And so you have this credential that I don't think most archaeologists do, which is you went back to school for an MBA at some point. And I was wondering, you mentioned sustainable careers just as some aspect of what's really important here. Was that an aspect of what led you to also get interested in business? Or could you tell us a little bit about your own journey and what encouraged you to do that?
Yeah, I've just kind of always innately been good at business, but in my job within kind of, you know, CRM and working for private companies, I've always had adjunct positions, okay. But my main career focus has been within private companies doing archaeology. And my job's got, you know, increasingly administrative as I kind of, you know, climbed the ladder, right? And I found that I didn't have the tool set that I needed on the business side, right? Because most archaeological businesses are run by archaeologists. It's starting to change where business professionals are being brought in, but that, you know, is kind of a new thing and a really good thing, I think. So, you know, I wanted to get a better tool toolbox. You know, I had a good toolbox. I had a Brunton in it, some trowels, a bunch of equipment, right? But I didn't have a very good business toolbox to cope with issues that the companies I was working for had. So I had the opportunity to go back to school, get an MBA, and it was incredibly valuable. You know, and I came out of that with a perspective that was really different. A lot of longstanding business problems that were invisible, I think, within the CRM community became very visible to me because I had a broader knowledge set. And I was like, whoa, this isn't a very good thing. And a lot of things that were recognized as problems, but nobody really had a solution for, you know, aren't unique to the business of, you know, archaeology or the business of cultural resource management. And, you know, I learned a lot in my education about how other businesses, how other industries had solved those problems. And there are a lot of answers. So I was able to bring those two things, you know, to the table. I really worry about cultural resource management as an industry, both within Canada and the United States, because the data that I look at, and one of the things my business does, Heritage Business International, is to kind of track the business economics of our industry. You know, we're not sustainable from a business definition. We're barely sustainable. Some companies are, some aren't, but industry as a whole, when you actually look at the metrics and the numbers, we're not truly growing. We're not truly, you know, returning value at a high enough rate to be considered by business professionals as being sustainable. And that scares me because of the changes that both of our countries have seen in how archaeology is practiced. If there's, you know, if we don't have a sustainable private sector archaeology, we kind of have not much archaeology at all. So, you know, that led me down this you know, mini career path, right? Kind of the third big phase of my career. I started out as kind of a more scholarly oriented Maya archaeologist dealing with issues of community organization in Mesoamerica. And then I had a phase when I was doing geospatial technologies and focusing on, you know, I was in at the early end of, you know, all our technologies, GIS, GPS, satellite remote sensing. So I caught the first wave of that and did that for a couple decades. And then, you know, I went back to school. So now my kind of personal mission is how do we improve business practices within our industry? How do we make it more sustainable? How do we create value, which feeds back into, you know, your question about jobs and sustainable careers and other things we really care about, you know, stewardship of resources, you know, learning about the past, community engagement, right? All those things depend upon us and depend upon private companies being sustainable and being around, right? Good science needs to be coupled with good business. At one time, they were held in opposition. Oh, you couldn't be you know, if you were making money at archaeology, you know, you couldn't be doing good scholarship. Or if you're doing good scholarship, you couldn't make any money, right? But we've learned since then, right? And the better you are as a business, right, the better the more resources you have to put into learning about the past and being able to hire better people and to be able to have labs with state-of-the-art equipment, we can do better archaeology if we're doing better business. Yeah. So they track together. They're not in opposition.
Yeah, it's sort of like the financial value can potentially create better heritage value out of, like, the work that we do.
Exactly. Yeah. They go hand in hand. Yeah. You know, we've always demanded good archaeological excellence within the industry, but we've always been really scared of bringing in outside business professionals to bring business excellence in. So we've relied on archaeologists trying to run companies, which generally isn't a very good idea, yeah, right? So we're getting to a point now where we recognize, hey, we need, you know, excellence on both sides, you know, that the business people aren't going to come in and tell the scientists what they should be doing, right? That has always been the fear. They could care less about what you're doing, right? Yeah. They just want to build a strong, sustainable company. And so we need excellence on both sides.
I think a lot of us have anthropology degrees as a way to escape taking courses that required a lot of math and business calculation stuff. So, yeah.
Always. They're opposite sides of the brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
We ran away to archaeology and anthropology because we didn't want to do business, right? Now we find ourselves, you know, in a world where we have to be good at business to ensure our success.
Yeah. I also think I've identified another topic we should have you on to discuss sometime, Chris, too. That would, I think, be a good episode here.
And so, on like the business side of things, so what is the role, kind of getting back to the SAA, what they're doing right now in terms of sort of two questions here. What's changed in the CRM industry and in the US in the last few months? What's affecting these kind of business trends? And what's the role that the SAA has been playing in lobbying and government relations on behalf of its membership and the archaeology field in general? And I suspect, and you might have these numbers, I don't know, but like I kind of always view the SAA as more of an academic society rather than a more CRM-based society. But I'm guessing you guys have a fairly large CRM membership, and I'm guessing these sorts of things have really come to the fore in the last few months in terms of like the advocacy that you guys do for CRM, the industry in general, eh?
Yeah. You mentioned, Ken, earlier on that I've been president of the American Cultural Resource Association and the Registered Professional Archaeologist in the past, right? And now I'm SAA president. Each one of those organizations has a very different mission and a distinct focus, right? With ACRA, which is akin to now the Canadian Cultural Resource Association, really is a trade organization focused specifically on those business and business issues, right? And then you have, the Register, which is focused on issues of standards and professionalism within professional practice. And SAA is much, it's much like CAA, right? It's a scholarly society, right? It's about doing archaeology and what we learn about the past. But SAA is big and it encompasses a lot of members. SAA has about 7,000 members right now, and members in all those kind of different employment sectors, in government, in private practice, in academia. And so therefore, SAA's positions and policy and initiatives to help members, right, are broader in that sense. But we take the lead on issues of standards and professionalism from the Register, and now we take the lead on industry issues from ACRA and CCRA and other groups like that. And but we've always been, I think, we being SAA, has always had a pretty strong policy voice about archaeology in general, issues in archaeology. And we have prominent government affairs committees at SAA, one really focused on U.S. domestic government affairs and one focused on international government affairs. So, and we're lucky, we have a full-time staff member at SAA as a paid staff. So we have a staff of about 11 people right now that are full-time paid staff members. One of them is the government affairs manager, and he is in D.C. So SAA, this isn't widely distributed yet, but SAA just gave up its office and it has gone virtual. So there is no physical office for SAA anymore, although most of the employees are still in Washington, D.C., where we used to be headquartered. And that's interesting from an international perspective, because now, we have the potential actually to hire employees from many different countries throughout the Americas than kind of solely, having to show up at an office in Washington, D.C. and being, very East Coast and very Beltway Washington centric. So hopefully that's going to be a good thing. But so we have, two committees that are like crazy, and it's all volunteer. It's members volunteering for these government affairs committees. And certainly the U.S. Domestic Government Affairs Committee has been incredibly, they put in tons of hours a week and meet weekly. And, they're the ones who write the drafts of the society's position statements and really take that first drafting and debate the issues and if we should weigh in, if we shouldn't weigh in, and what we need to say to help advance the mission of the society. So,
and the email that they send around is really, that's kind of a must read, I think, for archaeologists is that I can't remember how often it is, but really reading the whole thing is well worthwhile.
Yeah. And a big focus is that we're trying to, you know, we recognize that a fifth of our members are outside the United States. And the International Government Affairs Committee has never, you know, I mean, if you are a member and live outside the United States, there's a huge member benefit that you don't necessarily get. So we're trying to increase the International Government Affairs Committee to start, you know, getting more involved in advocacy for archaeologists outside of the United States, help support them in their efforts, you know. And a lot of doing that is, you know, the coordination and calls to action that go out in the newsletter you're talking about, but directly to members too. So we had one, you know, just here in the, about a month, maybe not even that, 3 weeks ago or a month ago in the States, where we had 2,000 SAA members go through the lobbying or advocacy portal that we have on the website to request the freeing of funding that was being held up in Washington, D.C. for our states and tribes to run their oversight offices, right, SHPOs and TIPOs. And that ended up being a successful effort. It wasn't all SAA, you know, kind of everybody was on board here in the States. But, you know, I mean, that's pretty amazing that we had, you know, that's like 25-30% of something are certainly of our members within the States took direct action, you know, because we were able as this organization with a large membership to make that a call and appeal and tell people, like, you know, now's the time, you know, take a second, log on, the portal sends everything out, makes it really easy. But that's something that we can and should and hopefully will be doing to help our members in other countries within the Americas too, here going forward. We want to ramp that up. Equity is a huge important thing. It's important for me and you know, what I'm trying to do here as president of SAA is some of it strategic, but some of it is because our membership growth is clearly outside the United States. But some of it is, you know, it's really expensive to be an SAA member if you live outside the United States, even if you live within the United States.
It is, yeah. The exchange rate's not great for Canadians right now.
That's yeah, exactly.
Sure. It's one advantage of the crashing American dollar, though, I think, is the, yeah.
To increase the, you know, inclusiveness, increase the equity of receiving benefits so that, you know, people will see it as you know, my business hat on, right? See it as, hey, there's a return on investment here for these expensive dues I send in. You know, somebody's out there fighting for my job, you know, which we're doing a pretty good job at fighting that fight within the United States, but less so in Canada and other countries. And we should do better.
Yeah. So speaking of that fight, Chris, and also speaking a little bit of you discussed the issue about SHPO and TIPO funding, which I think, you know, anyone who worked in the United States knew someone who was, you know, either affected by that or was waiting to be affected by that. Could you talk a little bit just about what are the implications of that situation? And do we know if longer term those offices are going to have stable funding? And really, if you want to take this as an opportunity just to discuss any other kind of new challenges that the last, you know, I don't know, few months have posed for archaeology in the United States or elsewhere.
And just for a reminder for our listener, the SHPO and TIPO acronyms are the State Historic Preservation Officer and Tribal Historic Preservation Officers, which are state level and tribal level representatives who basically oversee the Section 106 process. Would that be the simplified version?
That's the simplified version. I mean, they do a lot of other things, right? But it's a really weird, unique position within, under our major federal law, which is the National Historic Preservation Act, which is the federal compliance law. And what's weird about that act is that federal agencies are subservient to SHPOs and TIPOs of individual states. So when they comply, they go to SHPOs and TIPOs, they submit their findings and their recommendations, and SHPOs and TIPOs are a check in the system to ensure that these federal agencies have complied correctly. And they do a lot of other things, and they bring the local perspective and the tribal perspectives to the table, because a big federal agency doesn't necessarily know what's going on within each state or, you know, regions of states or areas or you know, on tribal lands. And so SHPOs and TIPOs provide a lot of content. They just do tons of stuff, and oftentimes their offices have state responsibilities in addition to this federal role and whatever. But, you know, but these offices, it's great that we got this funding freed because it was funding for this year, right, that got put on hold. So some shippos and tippos basically ran out of money and were laying off employees. It's slowing down the compliance process. You know, our government wants to, like, you know, build and drill, and there are all these administrative priorities, but they don't understand that by, like, withholding that money, even though they're trying to expedite those projects, which means less compliance, they're still, you know, these laws on the books, and they have to go through these offices, and, you know, without those people, it's just going to slow down their own projects. But, you know, stable funding into the future, no. And these offices have never had stable funding. You know, some of it does come from states, but a lot of it comes in these federal budgets. And every year, you know, we all within the United States are fighting, you know, and lobbying and advocating and educating in Congress to try to get that SHPO and TPO funding. A lot of that comes actually, it's really weird, to another little quirk, comes from offshore energy monies. It doesn't actually come from the federal budget, so it's not direct tax funded.
Really?
But
really,
it's always been allocated. It gets into the weeds here about how we fund. But, you know, but we're very much aware that while we won this short-term battle to get this money freed for this year, there's no guarantees that we're going to have money for SHPOs and TPOs in the next year's budget.
Yes.
So,
yeah. So the equivalent in Canada would basically be like if the provincial archaeology offices that are in every province essentially didn't know if they were going to have money to operate the next year, basically. And that's like on a year-to-year basis.
Yeah, it's a year-to-year.
Wow. Yeah.
Ken, don't act like you didn't live in Ontario when there was a government that thought that was a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Yeah. And where I'm sitting right now, too. So, you know, that's...
Yeah.
The funding has been restored, but I'm guessing, like, there's all sorts of other stuff that's gone on. And so what's the most pressing thing right now, I guess, in the U.S., situation before we kind of shift north of the border, kind of talk about what's going on in Canada?
Sure. I mean, people are scared. People are really nervous. You know, the things aren't going to necessarily change back to the way they were ever. You know, we're going into a new era with different rules, different laws, different regulations about those laws. And, you know, people are scared and people are nervous, right? And certainly research grants have been cut. You know, some have been restored, but the priorities of granting organizations are changing. And again, you know, some funded grants have maybe been restored, some haven't, but that doesn't mean that there's going to be grant money to fund archaeological research going into the future. You know, some primarily federal archaeologists have lost their jobs. Again, some have been reinstated, but others haven't. You know, the federal compliance process is being, you know, there are air quotes here, right, when I say they're being streamlined. You know, I think archaeologists are all in favor of streamlining and making the process more efficient and better. But, right, streamlining is always a buzzword for, you know,
deregulation,
right, and deregulating. And so that means currently, you know, we have some emergency, you know, mandates like energy extraction is an emergency, timber is an emergency. And that means that it goes through, you know, an emergency process, which means less is being done to assess the impacts of these projects on archaeological resources. So that's the bottom line. I mean, work is still happening, but not like it was. And it's starting to hit the private sector, right? And contracting opportunities, certainly with federal agencies for jobs, is starting to dry up a little bit. There are fewer advertised contracts now that people are starting to see. So it's taking a little while to trickle down to that level. But I'm hearing from companies that it's starting to happen.
And would that be like doing contract work for like the Defense Department or like the National Park Service and stuff like that?
Yeah, certainly those direct agency contracts. But even with private, I think the private company ones are better for now because the money and the funding for that. But with comes from those private companies and they get told by agencies. But, you know, it's getting to be like nobody at agencies or, you know, because people have either left or for whatever reasons, some have left on their own. Some have, you know, been fired or laid off. And, you know, and it's from what I'm hearing, there are people in positions now that really don't, you know, have the history to know how the process works, how decisions are made, and it's kind of just a mess internally, and that certainly spills over. I think, you know, with the private sector has always been pretty entrepreneurial. You know, the private sector will survive, but it's going to take some entrepreneurial thinking and seeing new opportunities and changing the way that archaeologists are doing business in the private sector to identify new needs, given this kind of new world going forward. But private sector has always been good at doing that. So, you know, I'm certainly not a doom and gloomer. You know, things are going to be different. That's not necessarily bad. We have to keep the key things in mind about, you know, which really go back to what I mentioned, you know, stewardship, learning about the past, protecting resources, empowering cultural stakeholders. You know, if we find different ways of doing those things, that, you know, maybe some of them will be even better, you know. So I'm trying to be optimistic. I'm trying to look forward. But I think, and I am moderately bullish on the private sector in finding unique solutions and good solutions. You know, I want us being archaeologists, I want us to be the ones to find the solutions to these problems, not government, you know, politicians or people who don't know anything about what we do or what we're trying to do or our history, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's great. I'm also just glad to hear moderately bullish, which I think is the most enthusiastic review of the current.
I just made a note.
That, high praise indeed.
Yeah, yes. I just made a note that we should try to find something positive to pull out here to, you know.
Yeah. This is good. But Chris, you've obviously got some interest in Canada. You've done some work with Simon Fraser and you've got business ties here. And so a couple of questions for our Can-Am relations side of things. Been a lot of talk about the border in the news, and there's also, you mentioned questions of equity, international equity and all this, and we just wondered if the SIA was seeing a change in its membership, especially in international terms, at the most recent meeting, and what sort of things are looking like for 2026 as far as initiatives out of the SIA for international membership.
Yeah, you know, membership hasn't really been affected, and I think if anything, I mean, it's grown. You know, during COVID, there was a big hit in membership, and, you know, SA clearly had some issues going on, and some people left for, you know, in protest for some of the things. But, you know, we got through both those, and membership has been growing steadily over the last 5 years. We're really close to where we were pre-COVID. We're up around 7,000 members. And I think now, you know, given the challenges that people are really realizing some of the value that they do get from SAA, you know, in fighting, you know, for jobs, fighting for archaeology, fighting for careers, and, you know, are more willing to pitch in to be members because they know that, you know, those dues are going to, like, our government affairs staff members and things like that, where they really are getting a tangible return on that. You know, our last conference was April in Denver. There was some talk about, you know, people not going. It was actually the seventh largest meeting in SAA's 90-year history. Wow. It was far larger than we expected. I think people were in an irrational good mood. Maybe it was camaraderie of, you know, being together with people and hard times. And I don't know what it was, but it was fairly upbeat, and it was a good meeting.
It's the further we get away from that meeting that was at the sort of weird Walt Disney adjacent place in Florida. I think that's what it is.
Yes, that was very strange. It's hard to find coffee. That's what I found was the hardest thing. So,
The mouse and coffee don't go to. You know, so I mean, there was a lot of talk. So a lot of our federal agencies have their own meetings at SAA, like a couple days prior. They canceled all those, but some of those federal archaeologists still came to the meeting.
Right.
Some under pseudonyms and things, but, you know, but clearly some federal archaeologists didn't come. At a normal meeting, we only get, you know, about 100 federal archaeologists anyway. It was low. We still got some, but, you know, and so it's unfortunate that perspective, you know, in that employment sector was reduced, but it didn't affect our overall numbers. And then internationally, you know, we were pretty apprehensive about, you know, whether international scholars and members would come to the meeting. For practical, you know, both political and practical reasons. You know, some people we know didn't come and protest because we heard from them. Some people didn't come because they were scared to travel to the United States, and, you know, rightly so. So we did some things to try to help. You know, we certainly worked through Denver, through the federal government to ensure that, you know, everything was up and up, that we told people what they needed to have in terms of documentation. We did hire a immigration attorney to have on call. Should somebody get, you know, locked up at the airport and not let into the country, we didn't have to use that attorney at all. And I heard from, you know, it's clearly it's not a good sample, right? But I did talk to some archaeologists from Asia, from Europe, and from Latin America who said it was surprisingly easy to come into the country for the meeting. Maybe that's not true for everybody, but it seemed like, I don't know if it was scare tactics, you know, with our administration, but it fortunately we didn't have any major issues. We do recognize this as a, you know, as a problem, potential problem, actual problem going forward. Our government affairs committee just drafted a list of tips for archaeologists and scholars wanting to travel to the United States for conferences, you know, or collaborations or doing research. So that's out there now, both in Spanish and in English, which hopefully will help guide people. It's guidance, right? There's no guarantees. It's just kind of advice that we're giving.
Yep.
And we'll drop that in the show notes folks can find it.
And, you know, we're always looking, you know, I think, to try to make it easier for people outside the United States. We have a really poor record, you know, despite having, you know, 20% of our membership, a fifth of our membership outside the United States, taking our SAE meeting outside of the United States. You know, we've had five or six meetings in Canada. They've always been super well attended, and our Canadian membership goes up those years because people want to attend. That's been good. You know, we're contracted for 4 years out only in the United States. I'm pushing pretty hard, as are some other members of our board, to the next meeting we can contract for. It's my hope, personally, that we can get that in Mexico, which we have met in Mexico City before, but it's been decades and decades and decades. But that would be huge for many of our Latin American members who it's really expensive to get a visa and really expensive to travel to the United States for a meeting. And, you know, a Latin American meeting would be far more accessible and affordable for them. Or, you know, if we can't do Mexico, maybe we come to Canada again. And those have always been pretty good meetings for us. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we're trying to, I think it's a new realization, actually, that how much of our membership is outside the United States. Mm-hmm. And so the board is trying to respond to that, you know, and to have us engage with other countries, other archaeologists within the Americas, evening out, you know, membership benefits, trying to be better about getting, you know, our meeting outside of the United States occasionally when we can. It's logistically hard, but it can be done for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like 7,000 back of the napkin, 20%, you're close to 1,500 members like outside of the U.S. So, you know, that does.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah, it's huge. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Listener, did you like how Ken pulled that number so seamlessly out of his pocket there? He's getting ready for his MBA, too.
The listener, so there's no video, so they couldn't see me pull my keyboard out and do a quick pull up the calculator app here on the screen. So just getting back to that kind of international perspective, and we had touched on this briefly before, and I think this would be kind of a good place to start to wrap up. We're cognizant of the time and you know, your time. So, on the regulatory side in Canada, we're starting to see some similar patterns emerge, less targeted, less splashy, less kind of like, less tweeting. But in the Canadian development world, we're seeing these changes that whether the SAA is considering at all some of the implications of, for example, federal Bill C-5 and the provincial statutes from Ontario, so Bill 5 and then Bill 15 in BC, how they're taking a similar approach at this and streamlining. I actually have the word streamlining in here, this buzzword, regulation and kind of increasing the pace of development. And so with this kind of new focus and this equity focus in the SA, are you guys thinking about how that works in terms of advocacy for archaeologists working north of the border?
Yeah, but as I mentioned, again, this is a new thing. We're trying to supercharge that International Government Affairs Committee to try to, you know, in this case, try to get those same types of benefits to Canadian members of SAA that our U.S.-based members have gotten. We've been way too U.S.-centric in our political advocacy, and we should be doing a better job in Canada and other countries within the Americas in doing that. And, you know, now that you've mentioned those bills to me, I'm going to bring them to the attention of our International Government Affairs Committee, because I don't think we've been tracking those. SAA, because of its kind of size and the resources that we have, we don't really get involved with state or provincial issues. We let the regional societies or the state-based societies tackle those, but we try to certainly, be an information source for those, but we really try to focus on the larger kind of national issues. I'll say to Canadian members and even to non-members, you know, because historically we've been lacking in being good advocates for issues in Canada, and helping archaeologists, you know, fight the fight, you need to get in our ears too. You know, let our Government Affairs Committee know about laws coming up, know ways that things we can do to help you, brief us on these issues, help us develop positions. And, I give you my word, at least during here, the remainder of my term in office, you know, I'm going to do the presidential arm twisting that I can to get those committees to start developing policy. And we have our staff member that we can use as a resource to, you know, draft letters, to lobby, to use our social media, to, awesome. You know, and our portal, which there's no reason that can't be expanded into Canadian politicians as well, to make it a really easy place for Canadian members to go and drop a personal letter and have it, you know, magically emailed off to policymakers and lawmakers in Canada. So, we're help us get there a little bit. You know, you guys in Canada know the issues. You know what the quote-unquote, again here, right positions are for archaeology. And so let us know what we can do to help, and we'll try on our side too to do a better job of stepping up.
And what's the best way, Chris, for concerned Canadian listeners to say get in touch with the SAA? Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot here, but
our government affairs staff has an email. Anyway, if you go onto the SAA website and go to like whatever it's called, you know, about SAA, you can get the list of staff and the areas that those staff people are, and their email addresses there. We have a government affairs section on the website, and there should be linkages and things there too.
Awesome. And we can drop that in the show notes too. Awesome.
That'd be great. So
that's,
you know,
great.
There's always been little petty fights among all the, you know, different archaeological organizations, and everybody has their issues and their positions. And, you know, I'll leave you guys with this. It's like, you know, now's the time we need to put those little differences away, because we have far more in common than we do have in different. And if we don't, there's just too few of us. If we don't put those differences aside and get together on the big important things, you know, we're all going to be in trouble. So let's do what we can to help each other. You know, SAA will step up some to try to help Canadian archaeologists, but, you know, you guys as well, let us know what we can do to help you.
Yeah, I've got great. The contact information now for Kimball Banks, it looks like, is the chair of the
He's the chair of our government affairs, yeah. And David Lindsay is the staff person, the full-time political affairs staff person.
Yeah, as the chair of the advocacy committee for the Canadian Archaeological Association, I you're speaking to me directly. That's actually the person to be.
So Chris, we're going to let you go here in a second, but you mentioned the phrase people are scared and people are nervous, and there's a bunch of desultory talk recently along the lines of just what would we tell students who are still looking to get into and make a career out of archaeology. And so what would you advise an undergrad exploring a career in archaeology right now? And, whether it's moderately bullish or fully bullish, I'd be curious to get your take.
Yeah, well, this is a case where I'm actually pretty pessimistic. And, you know, nobody wants to really talk about the dark side, and I'm always happy to do that. And let me say, you know, I'm I'm not going to discourage someone who has the passion for learning about the past and wants to go into archaeology down what has been our traditional career paths, you know, but we all know, but we rarely communicate that to these students, that it's a hard go, right? And, you know, you make a lot of sacrifices in your life to be a professional archaeologist. And it's not, you know, I'm a senior guy and a moderately well-known guy, and I'm still, you know, hustling the next job, you know? But if you have that passion and you need to have that passion, you can make it, right? And it's a tough go. That's why our challenge for all of us in policy is not so much the jobs, right? We have jobs, but making that jump from jobs to a well-paying, sustainable, rewarding career is where we have a problem. We have a lot of jobs, we don't have a lot of careers, and we need to figure out how to solve that problem. So that's the bad news, kind of. The good news is that the skills that we learn as archaeologists and or anthropologists are really great skills and highly desirable by industries directly outside of practicing archaeology. Right, we have quantitative skills, we have qualitative data skills, we usually speak a language or two, we understand culture and cross-cultural culture and globalization and international people, and man, private industries want to get their hands on those people. So you can take your archaeological skills and the things that you learn about culture and the past and history and apply those to another different industry where you may be actually doing very similar work. It could be in tourism. It could be in international development. It could be in, I don't know, you know, lots of different things. I just lost an employee who's a great employee, an MA archaeologist, because she didn't want, you know, she's far younger than I am. She didn't want the lifestyle. You know, she didn't want to make the sacrifices to be an archaeologist, but she's a great archaeologist and she's passionate about it. So what's she going to do? She's going to go back to school and get a teaching certificate. She wants to be a math teacher, and she can probably do more for advancing archaeology as a math teacher in junior high or high school than she can working directly in archaeology. You know, she's jazzed about developing lesson plans, using archaeological problem solving and archaeological data analysis and things like that to teach math to students through archaeology. And it's going to open the door, right, to many more people. So, you know, I think the students of today, they have a super different skill sets, right? They're far more communication oriented, you know, social media, they're savvy about communicating. You know, and I think they tend to be pretty entrepreneurial. You know, take your passion for archaeology. Well, one option is, you know, I mean, if you don't want to give up all those sacrifices, you can still participate in archaeology. Figure out, you know, go to business school, right? Figure out how to monetize your passion for archaeology in a different way where you can be a communicator, you can be an educator, you can do other things that may give you a better lifestyle, right? A more secure, you know, career, a better income, a more, you know, secure income, but still be able to be an archaeologist, really, but be an archaeologist in different ways that are not traditional ways. And the contributions you can make in those areas are no less so than, you know, being an archaeologist out digging a hole somewhere, or working for an agency or doing things like that. So, and many of those jobs actually suck the passion out of you, you know, that you once had. So if you can maintain that passion and just find creative ways of challenging that, I think that there are careers out there that can make a huge difference and still allow you to do that. But I don't know how we're going to solve, you know, the direct career problem within archaeology. I really don't. But we got to take that on. But, you know, the first thing we do need to do is recognize where the problem is. The problem's not with jobs. People talk the talk, you know, about jobs and jobs. Oh, we have jobs and CRM, but not really, I think, looking at what happens to those people who go into those jobs. And there are numbers on that and how long they last and what the lifestyle's like, what they do when they leave, you know, and it's not a pretty, it's not a pretty picture at all. It's a tough go, and it's really like 3 years. You know, as an itinerant, you know, field worker who jumps from company to company, job to job, and you get burned out. And some of those people go back to school, but only about 16%. This is on the U.S. side of the board.
This isn't an official stat, but I would say almost every person who's applied to do a master's in our program here are, you know, they've got 2 to 3 years of field experience and are looking for like what's next, basically. So, yeah.
So you're seeing that 16%, but what happens to the other? You can do the math there, quick, Ken, on your keyboard. Whatever that other 84%, whatever it is, right? Of those people go, I think they leave archaeology. They go on and do something else in their lives, and that's a real shame, you know. And we're not helping ourselves, and we're not helping them by when they were undergraduates saying, "Oh yeah, we have tons of jobs. Come be an archaeologist." You know, I think we need to have some straight talk and get real about what the problem is, and communicate that to our students and help guide them. An anthropology degree is hot, right? And the buzzword is business anthropology. But what that really means is you just go and you're doing anthropology, but you're doing it within another industry. And again, those skill sets that you get with that education are super valued. Focus on the skills you're getting. That's the advice I give people. Keep your passion. Look for creative ways of finding a good job to keep that passion alive, right? And to help everybody and focus on your skills and figure out where you can apply those great anthropological and archaeological skill sets.
Yeah. Or you know, go the MBA route, make lots of money, and then you can just like pay for your summers off doing archaeology work there. And that's a
sage advice from Ken Holyoke, listener, right there. That's the you can't tell how nice the bike behind him looks right now. That's, well, Chris Doerr, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk through some of this with us during what we're sure is maybe a surprisingly busy SAA presidency.
Yeah. Thanks again, Chris. This is great, and really appreciate your time. And like Gabe said, I've jotted down some notes for maybe the next conversation we have with you.
All right, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks, Chris.